Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
250.
Woo!
Hey!
Numbers, bitch. It's 250. And also, does this microphone sound okay? I'm trying a new one. Another one from Mitzi.
Thank you. Yeah, Mitzi. I mean, there was a little shifting motion there, but it's...
I just moved it.
Yeah, no, it sounds fine.
Good. Well, let's try this new microphone. I got this one, a Rode, R-O-D-E. The one I've been using is a Shure, S-H-U-R-E. Take this one out for a test drive. Mitzi also gave me this awesome camera, but I don't have a tripod for it. So I just balanced it on top of the screen like a moron. And then as soon as you came, it's on like a hair thin. And I got it to stay. And then as soon as you came on, I think the infinitesimal force of a new image appearing on the screen... That photon blast backwards, whatever the pressure is of a single photon, that push. It's an awesome camera. It looks a lot better than the built-in one in the Mac. I just need to get a tripod for it. So thank you, Mitch Perdue, microphone and headphone. And
hey,
as I was just telling Roger, if there's anyone smart enough to know how to figure it out, and you might not even need to be intelligent, I just might be a moron, is the diffuse lighting on studio lighting. Mitch Perdue, shout out Mitch Perdue, gave me some studio lighting, and it looks great, but I didn't know how to set up the contraption, so I just pointed the lights at me, and I got a migraine, and so I took some aspirin, and now I have all the lights down super low because I have a headache. But so it seems to me that I am the limiting reagent in this reaction of technology is here. I'm too stupid to use it. So it's there's a calculator, but I'm an ape, and I don't know how to use it. Calculator works fine.
I just had to drive 80 miles each way to set up a Chromecast for my dad.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's like he needed something to cast the screen for his new computer onto the TV so he could do the recliner thing and all. And
Well, that's what you're for. That's what sons are for.
Yeah. Well, that's basically how it worked out. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm this has nothing to do with anything, but I've been playing that video game Hitman. The last couple days, I've never played it. I think that game's been out forever. I've never played it.
Yeah, it's been out for a while. I mean, they had time to make a movie out of it.
Yeah, there's Hitman, there's Hitman 2. I didn't even realize I had bought Hitman 2, so I was just... Hold on. Excuse me. I'm splitting headache, dude. How I play video games is, as I've told you, I mute them. But even without the whole Audible thing, just in general how I play video games, even if I'm going crazy and turn on the volume of the video game, you know, really let my hair down, I like to turn off the mini maps. I turn off the... Why haven't I maximized the screen yet? I'm a moron. I turn off the mini maps. I turn off tutorials and hints and everything. And I turn off subtitles. No, what I like to do is I just like to, like, AI learning. I just like to go in and be like, what is the purpose of this game? And I'll just go in, I'll shoot somebody, and I'll get mowed down. I'll be like, I can't start shooting at a party. And I'll just kind of play games. And it will take me like 5 times longer than most people to beat a game. But it's my favorite way to play.
That's really the purest way to do it, though.
It's my favorite way.
I remember even when I think it was either Doom or Quake started doing that. And I was like, well, this isn't like you're experiencing it like a human being. This is like you're experiencing it like some kind of super intelligent asshole or something.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah. I don't like knowing the rules. I just like, that's my favorite thing, is to just like turn off everything. Yeah, like Watch Dogs, the game where you're like a hack. It's like the most cheesy like hacker man thing ever. You know, everything is like double keyboard hack. I'm in the mainframe now. But I love doing it and not having any hints, no tutorials. And you just mess around with something. And then like, you unlock something like 100 hours of gameplay in. You're like, oh, I can like remotely use a forklift with my phone. And it just changes the dynamic entirely. Now you're driving a forklift with a gas can on it out into the middle of the road and blocking the cops, and you're creating like IEDs, and it's
Well, if what you want to do is live the narrative that the game is trying to recreate, then that's the way to do it. Because if you're using all of these little cheats and stuff, then that's not the way that you would be. If that's not being the main character in the story, that's being someone who's read the story and is playing the main character.
Yeah, right. That'd be like if I just got like hints on like episode three, like a hint just popped up in my vision, and it was like, hey, Tommy, for your podcast, do this. And I'll be like, oh, okay, let's do this. But instead, it's just brutal, like, after 100 episodes of fucking up, and it's like, I should change something. So
anyway.
Anyways, Roger Williams,
back to you asked me to come up with a topic.
I did.
And I did. What I plan to talk about is, ultimately, big data.
Big data?
And particularly because you mentioned that cute little predator drone that flies around with all the cameras underneath it and takes pictures of everything like a panopticon.
Yeah.
And in a similar vein, we have a Louisiana Municipal Police Department that is asking everybody in sight to register their Ring doorbell cameras so that they can monitor them 24/7. Which is essentially the same thing, just with different data sources.
Yeah.
Oh, and I saw Eagle Eye.
You did?
Yes.
Did you like it?
Yes, you were right. It was a lot of fun. And the one of the things that I'll say about it is that I noticed that it was like a 26% tomato meter with the critics, but 62% with audiences.
Yeah, no, fuck
I've noticed
critics.
That when you have that divide where audiences like it better than the critics do, is generally one that Dad and I would go see and we would like.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the critics were like, well, they just blew shit up and all. But it was a lot of fun.
It's fun.
And it's not an original idea. Actually, if you see the movie I recommended, The Forbin Project.
I haven't yet.
You will find that Eagle Eye is almost a modernization remake of The Forbin Project.
Really?
The plots are very similar.
I haven't watched it yet.
Ideas. There is a lot of commonality between the two movies, except for the fact that they were made 40 years apart.
Sure, yeah.
And so it's a lot of fun to draw the comparisons with that, too.
Yeah.
But anyway, the whole thing is that this whole ability to record all the data and keep it forever is a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
It has only been possible for really 10 years or so.
Think only 10?
You saw the beginnings of it 15 to 20 years ago, but as far as being able to just keep everything everywhere from everybody, really 2010 is where I would put the gate for that.
Okay.
But anyway, I'm going to do the typical Roger thing, and I'm going to talk about that by going back way further and talking about some other phase changes that have occurred and what they meant and how they changed the way that people used computers and computing capacity to see what this might mean, since this is also a new thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if we go back to the beginning, in the 1940s when computers were invented, they were basically glorified calculators that were automatic. So they were basically tools for solving math problems. And in fact, you had to be a pretty sharp mathematician / programmer yourself to get them to do anything useful. This remained the case for practical purposes throughout the early 80s for like 40 years. That's what computers were. And that's one of the reasons they were so mysterious and people found them scary and difficult to understand, because they didn't really know what these things are used for.
Yeah.
But for the most part, what they were used for is to solve mathematical problems involving numbers.
Yeah.
Now, you might need the computer because you had a lot of numbers, because it's your accounting system. Okay, and it's all your transactions and collating everything. Or it might be because the thing you're trying to calculate has a lot of steps. Like you're trying to calculate pi to 500,000 decimal places. Okay, so that doesn't take a lot of memory, but it takes a whole lot of steps. And as things progressed, that's pretty much how it stayed. You didn't have people doing what we consider media. You didn't have people processing text. What you had was mathematical problems and the early games which games are kind of a sideline to the argument that I'm going to be making today, because for the most part, games have followed what the computer could do. They haven't driven what computers can do. Mm-hmm. The only exception very recently, you have the graphics processors for 3D games, but that's a sideline. That's a niche. That's not the kind of mainstream sort of thing that I'm going to be talking about. What I'm talking about is if you find a random computer somewhere on the face of the earth, what is it most likely to be being used for? And until the mid-80s, that was going to be either mathematical problems, hydrodynamics, such as the
hydrogen bomb.
But also things like river flow, simulating the weather, stress calculations for mechanical assemblies. So you had this, but again, that's not something that your average individual user is doing. You have a few power users who are buying big, what were then big computers to do those things. But what most computers were until the mid-80s were either toys, you know, they were educational toys. The games that they made it possible to play were themselves the stuff of educational toys. The whole thing is the game would suck you in into trying to figure out how the computer works. And so you would learn how the computer works. And the next thing you know, some engineering firm can hire you and you can write Fortran programs to do real shit. But that, you know, those games were not the end thing. Yeah. They, you know, people are looking for stuff these computers could do. But if you ask yourself about word processing, the TRS-80 Model 2 could not display lowercase characters. The Apple II couldn't display more than 40 columns. The Commodore 64 and all of the other computers that use your TV set as a monitor couldn't display more than 40 columns, which may be miserable for use is serious word processing machines. Now, there were hardware fixes for a lot of those machines. There was a ROM upgrade for the TRS-80 that made lowercase possible. There were upgrades for the Apple and for the Commodore and for other computers of the day that made 80 columns possible. Of course, that meant you had to buy a monitor because you can't use your TV set anymore. But those things were expensive. They were niche uses. So yeah, if you're a professional writer, then you might invest in this. But if you're a random nerd user, then you probably haven't done this. And plus, at those days, all that hardware required software packages that were aware of it. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was even true of sound cards until the 90s. You know, it's like you, the game you're playing has to be aware of the particular model sound card you have, or it can't even make beeps and whoops and play tinny music.
What do you mean aware?
The guy who wrote the game has to include the driver for that hardware in the game. There's no operating system that mediates. So it's like on modern computers, if I write a program that wants to play a sound, I just tell the operating system, here's a file with a sound, play it. Okay. The operating system doesn't care how your sound hardware works.
Okay.
Right now I'm using this USB connected thing. I've got my my Bluetooth headphones I normally use to listen to music. They have a microphone in them, but it's crap, which is why I'm not using them.
Yeah.
There's the built-in hardware. For my program, they're all the same because the operating system levels it out. That was not really done until the 90s for most computers. So if your game wanted to have sound, if you wanted to do like Duke Nukem 3D had I'm here to kick butt and chew gum. Well, in order to play that clip, Duke Nukem had to have the hardware driver for the particular sound card that you had built into it. And you would select that when you were setting the game up. That would be part of the game setup. What sound card do you have? So none of this is practical. Okay? You know, this is something that the hardcore users would do, but your average guy is not doing stuff like this.
I need to email you something after this. As soon as you said Duke Nukem, I've just started losing. There's this fucking meme. It's like a 10-second video some dude made, but it's called Dick Kick'em. It's so stupid. It's like third grade humor. But he's like, my name's Dick Kick'em. He's like, I'm here to chew dick and eat ass. And I'm and the guy doing the voice can't keep. He's like, and I'm all out of ass. And it's It's you have to have the maturity of an 8-year-old, but it's as soon as you said Duke Nukem, that game flying back into my head.
That was an example of where the games pushed things. You know, the guy who wrote the video engine for Duke Nukem, this is kind of a sidetrack, but he was a big fan of id in their early games, and he decided he wanted to write one of his own. So he wrote what was basically a fanfic game. He wrote his own video engine. He wrote his, you know, his own thing. And they licensed his engine to do Duke Nukem 3D. So this was something where, as a teaching device, the computer taught this guy to program. And this was all done in like assembly language and low-level stuff. And you had to be really aware of how the hardware works to get maximum performance for it to do anything useful. So this is kind of where computers were. This is what you would use the computer for. It's almost to teach yourself computers was the purpose of the computer.
Okay.
And that was pretty much the case until the mid-80s. And several things had to happen simultaneously to change that. You needed a display device that can display a decent amount of text, upper and lower case, with some emphasis markers. And that pretty much meant you had to have a monitor. Unless you were doing it. Now, the Coleco Atom booted into a word processor, and I had one.
I had a Coleco.
And that was cool because it was a super cheap machine and very capable, but it was the first consumer machine that didn't boot into a programming language. You know, if you think about it, if you bought a Commodore 64, an Apple II, or a TRS-80, all of those machines started up by putting up a prompt that said, ready.
Mm-hmm.
And you needed to learn some commands to tell it what to do.
Okay.
The Atom boots up into an electric typewriter. You can type shit on it and print it on the daisy wheel printer that comes with the system. And that daisy wheel printer was a big thing, too, because at the time, your typical computer printer was a piece of crap. And a lot of publishers had told their people, we do not want to see manuscripts printed on a 9-pin dot matrix printer. It's too hard to read. It's crap quality. So that drove – well, 24-pin dot matrix printers came pretty quickly, and they were almost good enough. They were gradually accepted. But if you were really serious, you got a daisy wheel printer because that produced output that looked exactly like a typewriter because it was a hammer knocking on the daisy wheel pedals just like the hammers of the typewriter – knocking against the ribbon and all. And so the publisher could not complain. This looks just like something that came off a typewriter. That's what they expect.
Yeah.
But they're slow, they're noisy, they're not as capable because they can't do graphics. So it's a compromise. And again, most people who are not serious writers didn't do that. They didn't have this. So there's this confluence, though, in the mid-80s. That, you know, you had like the Osborne Model 1, the first portable computer. It was portable because it was only the size of a suitcase and it only weighed 20 pounds, so you could lug it around. And it didn't have batteries, so you still had to plug it in. Yes. But you could take it to the hotel room and actually do work if you were on a book tour or something. Oh, and it cost like $2,500 in the 1970s.
But that's still baller. If you had a fucking suitcase computer in the 19... That's James... That's, you're a step above James Bond.
Oh, it was.
Rest in peace, Sean Connery. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I have one that I bought at Goodwill for like $25. Years and years later, I couldn't resist it just to have one.
Yeah, yeah.
The disk drives don't work right anymore at all, but it's just like, because this is one of the things that changed the world. It was a few years ahead of its time. But where everyone started to get on the bandwagon was around 1985, give or take a couple of years. That's when the PC, the IBM PC, came along and everybody had dedicated monitors for it. You had monitors that could display 80 columns, upper or lower case. You had Hercules monitors. Later, you had VGA. CGA monitors were not so good, but the machine itself had enough memory, had enough mass storage. They all had disk drives. So you had the combination. You had enough RAM to hold a good window of the text you're working on to deal with text. You had enough mass storage, random access mass storage, tapes don't cut it, to hold your whole document. If it's a novel, The Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect is about 60 kilobytes.
By Roger Williams, available on Kindle and hardback, paperback, and of localroger.com as well as Amazon.
Yes.
Being the top link, right. End of the bio.
Okay. Now, as many people like to point out, it's a short novel. It was a typical novel.
It's a great novel.
Yeah. But it is a typical novel of the 60s as far as length. It's okay. About 60,000 words, and it takes about 60 kilobytes of disk storage to store the image. Longer novels, you start getting into when they were selling them by the pound in the 70s. Well, it was a good thing floppy drives were getting denser because you might need that 720K or 1.44 meg, 3.5-inch floppy drive. Those were your gold standards in the 80s as far as portable data transfer. So you need to bring it between different computers and stuff. But you had that. You had printers. The early laser printers were completely out of reach for normal people. But you started to have 24-pin dot matrix, and they weren't too expensive. And the publishers and people like that started to be a little less pissy about it. And all of a sudden, in the mid-late 80s, everyone was word processing on their computers. You suddenly had a lot of computers that the only thing they were used for was word processing. Maybe games too, because all computers are used. It's like all computers are used for whatever games the computer is capable of. But if you had a computer that was earning, that was being used for something important, that was making someone money or making their living, before 1985, it was mathematical. They weren't okay. doing text.
Okay.
By 1990, a lot of those computers were being used strictly for word processing, text processing, because you could go in and you know, edit your stuff and correct errors and all without printing 27 copies as you went along and using a bunch of whiteout and reams of paper.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And it made it possible. I personally cannot write without a word processor. When I was in high school, there were no word processors. They didn't exist. And I had a dream of being a writer, but I really couldn't make it work because I could not get my thoughts onto the page fast enough and accurately. Now, that was a skill that I might have learned eventually if I had no choice.
Yeah.
To this day, you've got people like Joe Haldeman who prefer to work on a manual typewriter. That's the way they're learned. That's their habit. But no, I needed a word processor. And there's a lot of people like me out there that, you know, that made the difference. So you had all these college students writing their term papers and this sort of thing. And that had not been a thing at all before the mid 80s. By 1990, I would speculate that if you did the pick a random computer, see what it's being used for thing, it was probably more likely to be being used for word processing than anything else. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, that happened about the same time for businesses too, because even though computers that could handle text were available in the late 60s and 70s, if you were willing to spend $10,000 or $15,000 on them, businesses weren't spending that money to put a computer of that power in front of a secretary. That's why they have secretaries. They have a typing pool. The way you rework a document is you mark it up and you give it to the secretary and you ask her to retype it. That's the way that technology worked until those machines got cheap enough to put one on every executive's desk and tell them, you need to learn to type yourself.
Yeah.
Before, we're sending her down to the
Before that, it was just whiskey and cigarettes and, you know, a lot of womanizing and grab ass. This is what I want, Pam. And it was good for a while.
Hey, oh man, you seriously overloaded your new microphone there.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Fuck. Did it get way too loud?
It started distorting.
Okay. How about now?
Oh, it's fine at normal volume, but yeah, you did that little shout. And it seriously overdrove your mic.
Okay. Something. Okay. Hey, learning process, baby steps. But yeah,
That's why I'm trying to help. Okay.
Woo. Thank you. So yeah. So now.
So we reached like roughly 1990.
Okay.
Now what you're doing here, what you're not doing on your computer in 1990 is viewing any kind of entertainment media at all. Period.
Okay.
Unless it is some kind of game that has been made very carefully so that it is within the capabilities of the computers of the day. You're not listening to music. You're not watching God, you're not watching video. Nothing is capable of that. You don't have the mass storage. You don't have the processing power. You don't have the file formats. Okay.
Well, government probably did.
Not really. That's really? The thing. A bunch of things came together in the mid-90s.
Okay.
Okay. One of the first was the compressed formats for music, pictures, and video. Around 1995 was when you finally saw the public consolidation of the JPEG, the MP3, and the MPEG movie formats for doing compressed things. All of those reduced the amount of data you needed by a factor of about 10. So before that, you had digital video. You had compact discs. Compact discs or digital video. They had those in the early 80s. But they depended on the plastic disc, which had a massive data capacity, 600 megabytes, which in 1982 was like, wow.
Yeah.
That's, okay.
Yeah.
So, but in the beginning, the only way you could make a CD was by creating a die and casting. This is a very expensive process that was only worth it if you're making a whole shitload of them.
Yeah.
So they didn't have recordable CDs until, again, the mid-90s. That was another thing that came about, was they figured out how to make this die style instead of the aluminum foil thing to use that format. But your hard drives in the 90s were like, I bought a computer in the early 90s. My first portable computer was a Tandy FD or HD 1400. It had a 20 megabyte hard drive. Okay. Hey, I was impressed. I mean, it's like, man, I can put every text document I ever create on this thing. Yeah. I'll never need a bigger one.
That's how I feel with my 10 terabyte. No, I have a 16 terabyte external. I showed you Mount Weather.
Yes, it's, of course you do.
Yeah. But of course I do, right? I have a 16 terabyte. And it's the same sort of, it's that freedom. I'm like, I fucking throw everything on that. I'm like, but now I'm there's kind of a little bit of nervousness because I have all the podcasts on it and I'm looking at it and now it's at like 5.5 terabytes and I'm like, fuck, I'm actually going through it. I'm like, shit, it's actually okay. But yeah.
Yes, sorry. It is still finite.
Yes.
Okay, so in the mid-90s, you have hard drives approaching 100 megabytes toward the middle of the decade. Now, with the compressed file formats, what that gives you is the ability to store a few songs on a hard drive.
Okay.
Real songs, actual random audio, not like tone encoded things for the
Mario
Commodore VIC chip or something, but no, real actual voice or music.
Yeah.
And that had been impossible.
Okay.
It had literally been impossible 5 years before.
Okay.
In fact, before the mid-90s, there was no video card for the PC-compatible computers that could display 24-bit video. If you wanted to display a photograph, you had to carefully process it to pick an appropriate color palette. It was a time-consuming process and not all photographs could even be encoded in a way that could be displayed on a VGA display with a 256-color palette. It was not until the 90s that you started to see 24-bit video cards. Apple had some. In the late 80s, Apple was marketing hard to education and to graphic artists, people who were in like the magazine industry. So you had photographers, you had layout artists, and they were using these machines to actually manipulate photographs. Photoshop itself went back to like 1988.
Yeah.
But you needed a $20,000 machine to use it.
Yeah.
To have enough memory, to have a good enough video card and all. Well, that stuff finally trickled down to ordinary consumers in the late 90s. And so what happens is two things happen almost simultaneously. And they both happened around 1998. On the sound front, Napster is founded.
Napster and then LimeWire, yeah.
Yeah. Now, what happens there is you're still probably not using your computer to play music because your computer's probably a tower. The laptops of the day were very inferior to the desktop computers, and you needed a powerful computer to do this. But if you could snag a cable modem, or even if you were doing dial-up, if you were dedicated enough, you could download a song. And downloading a 3-minute song probably took about 20 minutes if you were on dial-up. But you had a big enough hard drive to store it and to play it to make sure it was good. And you had a big enough hard drive to download enough of those to make a CD. And then what you did is you burned them onto CD. And deleted the files to make more room on your hard drive.
Naturally.
To put your CD in, and you would still listen to the CD with your CD, you know, with your audio dedicated equipment. But now you're able to download all this music and create a collection without paying for it, which is like, woohoo.
This is what I do every day with my podcast. I take all the video, I kick it off to the hard drives, and in the fucking NORAD safe, kick it all off, clear it out again, and it's ready for a new. If I'm feeling a little dangerous, I'll do two podcasts in a row and leave it on the laptop. If I'm getting a little crazy, if I want to play on the edge, do I have enough memory? Who knows?
So and that gradually, starting in the late 90s and moving in, I didn't get on Napster myself until the early aughts, so it had become pretty advanced. You know, I had a DSL modem when I started with it. But you still had a lot of people who were on dial-up.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, you would encounter someone who was like on a university mainframe hookup. And it's like, I remember the time that I downloaded the entire Beatles White Album in 5 minutes flat.
Yeah.
It was like...
Which was insane, yeah. You get on LimeWire, yeah.
I was so impressed.
Yeah. When you picked up like 100 songs in an evening, you were just like, I'm a fucking gangster.
And the funny thing is that before this happened, I had laboriously gone through our entire vinyl record collection and digitized all of them, cleaned up the pops and shit that, you know, and turned them into CDs. And then I took and downloaded all of those songs and made new CDs that had obviously been encoded from CDs in the first place and were much better quality from Napster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So this is the sort of thing that people were doing in the early 90s, okay? The other thing in video. Now, pictures are about comparable to, you know, still pictures are comparable to songs in complexity. But the use case for looking at still pictures on your computer is not very good because it's inconvenient. It's not, you know, you don't want to put your family snaps on the computer. It's not the same as having a photo album where everyone can gather around. Mm-hmm. Okay. And for sure, you're not looking at video. The video that you could display in 1998 was really crap. I mean, if you display that video on a modern monitor, it's like about the size of a postage stamp unless you...
Yeah.
Blow it up so much that you say, my God, this thing is so blurry. Who would put up with this?
Yeah.
Because if you were watching video on your computer in 1998, it was porn.
Which?
Full stop.
Episode
that was
with,
the only kind of video that was worth messing with.
It's the only thing. Computer. That's the only thing you'd fuck with, literally and figuratively. That's the only thing you would watch. That's the only thing that was worth it. Was like, okay, I know it's got 10 pixels, but boobs. And it's just like...
Yeah.
It was worth it.
Yeah, because it was something you couldn't get anywhere else.
You couldn't
get it by any other medium, so you put up with the crap quality. And it was pretty much the same for still photos, although the still photo porn was much better quality in that day because you could at least download a VGA quality photograph that was like at least not stupidly blurred.
Yeah.
But that was the thing. So you had the age of computers as number crunching devices. Then you have the age of computers being used as text processing devices, which was a completely new thing that had not been possible before. And now you have computers as the engines of music and porn.
Yeah, and for everybody listening, go back to way before with Roger Williams. He did a history of pornography. It's an awesome episode for all the new users, or new listeners, sorry. But yeah.
Yeah, so... This is where things are in the early aughts, the 2000s come. Now, I bought a computer in 2003, similarly to the way I had bought one a little over 10 years earlier, because I needed to take a business trip. And I was mainly interested in having a portable computer I could do text processing on. And I was astonished when I got it home and realized that the optical reader was a DVD player and the thing could play a DVD. I was like, seriously? This computer can play a video disc.
Yeah.
And that was the leading edge where actual watchable video was starting to be a thing. That machine had a 20 gigabyte hard drive. Now, a DVD has a capacity of about 4 gigabytes. So right there, you're about where you were in the late 90s with music, where you can put a few DVDs mm-hmm. on that hard drive or download one if you feel like sitting there for 3 days and then burn it onto a plastic disc so you can delete the image and download another. And I know people who had massive video collections that they built that way.
Yeah.
Okay. But again, the hard drives are getting bigger. It's getting more and more practical to just leave your video collection on the hard drive. Plus, things like phones are starting to get to the point where you can play a movie on them. So you might take your sound, you know, you might, you know, so you've got your 100 movies in 2010 on your terabyte hard drive. And you might download a couple of them onto your phone to watch on your airline flight that you're about to take.
Yeah.
But this is where things sit. So now you have the age of video where you're starting to watch video. Now, all that happens after this is things get easier and better quality. The video goes from being the plastic disc, you can keep it on your hard drive, to you got high definition as well as the old stuff. And you're able to edit and create as well as just download and watch. This is all what happened to music 10 years earlier until we reach the modern day, when it basically just means everybody has a fucking studio on their desktop in the form of their computer if they want to get the interface devices. But there hasn't really been another age like that for consumer devices. When you ask where the next shoe is going to drop, some people think it's going to be virtual reality. And I don't think so, because I think virtual reality is an inconvenient pain in the ass. I think it's going to remain a novelty. You're going to have the power users, just like you've got the people right now who'll pay $3,000 for a GPU so they can play their game at 3,000 frames per second or whatever. But it's not going to be a common use case to do something else new with the computer. I don't see what's going to be that new thing. But now you've got everybody in the goddamn world watching video on their computers. They've got their computers hooked up to the internet, and they're freaking streaming video to their TV set through the computer, or through something like a computer that's even simpler and stupider than a computer. But that's the state of the art. You know, this is the age of video. And the thing is, the movie studios saw it coming, and they did everything they could to tamp it down. They saw what happened to the music industry.
Yep.
And they went balls to the walls on the offensive against it, and they've been playing whack-a-mole for the last 15 years.
Yeah.
But they shut, you know, it's like, okay, we, you know, they poison all of the BitTorrent seeders and start prosecuting people and sending nasty grams to their ISPs, and the guy they come up with something else.
Yeah.
And the dedicated people who really are super into it, They just come, you know, whatever the new thing is, they get into it, they find out how to make it safe, they have VPNs, they're doing whatever they need to protect themselves. And the, you know, so the whole thing is like, well, that particular thing isn't a common use case. Not everybody bothers to do that, but, you know, more and more people are. Mm-hmm. It's like, is that the number of complete computer noobs that I have met who have a jailbroken Fire Stick.
Yeah.
Is like more than the number of actual programmers that I know in real life.
It's this beautiful digital Darwinian. Really, it's a digital Darwinian dogfight. It's just ramping up more and more, and just going at each other.
Okay, so video was the last shoe to drop for individual users, the last great age of new use for computers. Yeah. So we had number crunching boxes, text crunching boxes, music and porn, actual movies, and that's where we are, only all of that stuff is more convenient and easier to do and better quality than ever. But there has been another age for businesses, and that is big data.
Okay.
Now, my leading edge onto this. When I am not writing transgressive web novels and doing podcasts with you, I actually build industrial control systems. So I'm building these computer systems that collect data. Maybe they're collecting all of the transactional data for the trucks that you weigh in and out of your plant, or all of the bags that you're filling on a filling line, or, you know, things like that. And so these systems generate data, and it's useful to collect this data so that it can be analyzed or reviewed later or whatever, okay? And up until about 2010, I had always had to put a mechanism in to delete the old data at some point to make room for the new data, because you would fill up the hard drive or whatever storage. I mean, in the beginning, it was floppy disks.
Yeah.
And around 2010, I realized I didn't have to do that anymore. It was like, there's no reason to delete the old data. The computer's fast enough and powerful enough to go indexing through it if I want to keep it as a web archive. So a lot of the programs that I wrote, you know, there's a web archive that can be served with a web server, and the home page is a list of years. You click on a year, you get a list of months. You click on the month, you get a list of days. You click on that day, and you get all your transactions for that day. Boom. And in around 2008, 2010, I started adding pictures to that. So I'm not going to name any names, sure, but there was a particular customer that had a big fraud problem. And because their truck scales are located out in the middle of nowhere with individual operators, and they had a problem with paying for things that were not what was delivered on the truck. So we built a system for them that would take a picture of the truck when they weighed it and recorded all the other data. So that comes off of network IP cameras. Most of those have, you know, of course, we all know they have that cute little interface that the video software uses and all, but most of those cameras have a URL that you can hit that will return the current frame as a still image. And so it's really easy for me to write a program that hits that URL, grabs that frame, and saves it as a JPEG somewhere, creates links to it, whatever, okay? Yeah. Now, about 3 years ago, I migrated a system from one of my customers who had been using one of these things for about 5 years. So he had four high-definition pictures of every truck that he had weighed through his facility for 5 years. The archive, it was 10 gigabytes.
I was about to say, yeah, the size of that.
It took 3 hours to copy it onto a thumb drive so I could move it to his new server. And he was looking at me and going like, well, Roger, maybe you should delete some of this old data. And I was like, why? No. This server has a 10 terabyte hard drive. This is less than a tenth of a percent of its capacity.
Well, we got to be careful.
By the time you get to 1%, you'll probably have a hard drive that's 10 times bigger on the even newer server that you're going to install. So there's no reason to delete the data anymore.
Never delete data. Don't ever delete data.
That has become the norm
everywhere. Keep everything.
In the early 2000s, Gmail came out with this gigabyte on, you know.
Yeah. So,
because before Gmail, even if you had an online mail account, you had to delete your old emails or your inbox would fill up and you wouldn't be able to receive email anymore because your inbox is full.
Yep.
Well, Gmail comes along and says, we're going to give you a gigabyte. Who's ever going to fill that up?
Yeah, well, now,
But I remember, you know, people were so that, you know, they were using Gmail accounts like G Drive is used today because there was nothing else like it. They were using it to share files. They would like upload a file to their Gmail account and then share the login credentials so other people could download it. And there was a thriving black market economy in Gmail recommendations because you couldn't just log on and get yourself a Gmail account. You needed a recommendation. Yeah. So if you could give a Gmail recommendation, that was coin.
Some shekels. Yeah. Right. It was.
You could get some quid pro quo for that shit. And now it's like, I don't even know how many emails I got in my Yahoo account. The thing is, you know, I've got like every time I have ever sent anyone a program, I've sent it with my Yahoo account. And I've had people say, do you have a copy of that program you sent me 5 years ago? And it's like, as a matter of fact, I do.
As a matter of fact, I do. Yeah, that's, hey man, I think I have 27 Gmails. No, I'm not kidding, because I had 27 Reddit accounts, because I'd, you know, I'd post my shitty memes and then upvote them. And then one day this past summer, July 2020, there was a night of the long knives. They killed 25 of my 27 accounts. They pinned me. I had no way of knowing. I was surrounded, Roger. They killed me. But point being, yeah, you can just, I just have them just to fucking throw away.
But the thing is too, they can offer these services because storing the data has become so cheap.
Fucking cheap, yeah.
It's like if you pay for a Dropbox account, they don't just store your data. They store every version you've ever uploaded.
Yeah.
If you change a file, they don't delete the old version. You can find, which is why they say it's one of the safest things. If you get hit by ransomware, the ransomware will encrypt your Dropbox. Oh my God, what am I going to do? Oh, you just go to Dropbox and get the last version, because they have every freaking version that you've ever uploaded of your files.
It's beautiful.
So you just delete the new encrypted ones and put the old ones back.
It's beautiful.
But this is also true in every other sphere. It's become, you know, and it's like the progression with other things. It was true of text at a certain point. Then a few years later, it became true of audio, and it became true of still pictures, and then video. To the point now, if you have a security camera, there's no reason to ever delete any of the footage.
Yeah.
And this is a phase change.
Mm.
Okay, because now you've got, first of all, not only that, but cameras have become so ubiquitous and so cheap and so easy to put anywhere you want. High resolution,
too.
And, you know, high resolution. So now it's like you never know if there's a camera. One of the major scandals with Airbnb is people leaving freaking cameras running to monitor their thing when your visitors might be having sex or something.
Which is fucking...
It's like, how do you balance that out? Yeah, okay, it's our house. We're renting it out, but we want to make sure they're not trashing it. And they're like, yeah, but we also don't always wear clothes when we're walking around the house that we're living in.
It's that double-edged sword that will go forever. I was going to say, I have a kind of a, I don't want to get on a sidetrack, but I'll just put it out so we can address it later. They say intelligence agencies can look through your apertures on everything you have. One thing I was thinking of is I was like, we're going to find out in 50 years that not only can they look through, but they actively recorded everything from everyone, that there's just going to be like hundreds of exabytes of data.
Yeah. Well, that's where we're going. We're not quite there yet. But that's where it's heading, because there's a police department in southern Louisiana that has started asking everyone to register their Ring doorbell cameras to monitor them 24/7. And it's the same thing as that Predator drone, Gordon's, but a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
And the thing about that is, even if you don't opt in, if your neighbor across the street opts in and their camera is pointed at your house, then all your comings and goings are being recorded.
Is there going to be a market for like digital cloaking? You can just throw up a fake image in front of your house, like a hologram?
That is not physically possible.
Shut up, Roger.
There's no technology like that.
Fuck you. This podcast is over. Have a good night.
Oh, it gets worse. Oh, I'm not even getting started. Okay, so you've got these things going on, and you've got the incentive, the perverse incentives. Okay, you've got other data sources. Of course, Facebook has all of your interpersonal communications with your friends, your family, the not-so-secret members of your not-so-secret-anymore society. Okay? Google Maps, most people do not realize, records everywhere you go.
Yeah.
And that's the way they build that cool traffic view display.
Yeah.
Where do they get the data that they can tell there's a traffic jam on Causeway Boulevard? It's because all of the other people running Google Maps, their phone is constantly reporting their position and velocity so that the servers back at Google can go, oh man, the cars are not moving on this stretch of Causeway Boulevard. We need to turn it red.
Yeah, and it's that balance.
Which is cool. And the thing is, it's cool.
That's a really good thing, right? But you got that balance.
It is.
Swords and plows. Yeah.
And where else are you going to get that data? But it also means that Google knows everywhere you have ever gone.
Why does that matter, Roger? Just open up. Just allow Big Brother into your heart.
Well, I'm getting there.
I'm getting okay.
So, and there's a few other things like this. You know, it's all of this data, and no one has any incentive to ever delete any of this data.
Yeah.
Now, they're supposed to. The fig leaf that they hide behind is that they anonymize it. They remove the individual identifying information. So all they have is the statistical information of how many cars were moving at this speed on Causeway Boulevard. They don't remember your IP address.
Of course not.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
If you believe that, I got a bridge to sell you. Yeah. It's 24 miles long. Best bridge ever. It's the best, totally cool.
The biggest. It's the best, most golden American bridge ever built by Americans.
It was, yes. So the thing is, even if they're supposed to delete this data, even if they've sworn on a stack of Bibles in front of the Senate committee, we have deleted all of this identifying information. There's two problems. One is that security researchers have gone through and shown if somebody is dedicated enough yeah. and interested enough in your movements and yeah. your stuff, they can go through this anonymized data and they can still reconstruct the part of it that's you.
Yeah.
There's enough data.
Yeah. If you want to.
None of these teams are good enough to really protect your privacy. And the other is that any of these companies, if they were really deleting this data, someone would be fired. Because that data is gold.
That is money, money, money.
There's no way they are really deleting that data because that is so valuable.
Yeah.
There's no way. And I don't, you know, again, if you think they're really deleting that data, the Lake Pontchartrain Causeway is up for sale, dude.
Contact Roger. Yeah, you can contact.
I will cut you a deal.
You can contact Roger. Yeah, he.
Now, what they're doing is, because the thing is, it's very hard to prove that they have this data. You know, they're keeping it on the QT.
Yeah.
Because it might be valuable one day. They're not supposed to have it today.
Yeah.
But one day the environment might change. That might be okay to have this data. Yeah. Meanwhile, they might be able to use it. They're kind of in the same position that the Allies were after they cracked the Enigma code.
Yeah.
Once you have all this intelligence, once you have all this data, how do you use it in a way that doesn't tip their hand?
That you have it.
That you have it.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you can't let them know. You can't let them know, right?
And the most damning story I have ever heard about that was one you told me about the pictures on your iPhone that you take of the booze in the storage room at the liquor store.
Oh, yeah. And then it starts showing up on my Instagram.
Because you don't do anything with those pictures.
I don't drink. And I don't upload them. Yeah, they're shit. They're shit.
You don't upload them. You don't share them. All you do is look at them on the floor out in the liquor store to see what you need on the shelves.
For everyone listening, I worked at a liquor store for a while, and they have a big back room. You go in, you take pictures of the stock, and then you go out front, and you can make notes of, okay, we have Jack Daniels, and we need Jack, blah, blah, blah. So I just have thousands of photos of just liquor on my phone. The other thing is that they're not worthy photos. They're not anything worth posting because I'm not 16. Let's get drunk. Second of all, I don't drink. So, and it starts showing up on my Instagram.
Yeah. What you do with it doesn't even matter. The thing is,
they have it.
The reason that they have these photos is your iCloud.
Yes.
Apple.
Yep.
Your iPhone that uploads everything to the cloud. And the whole purpose of that is supposed to be that if you accidentally drop your phone in a vat of battery acid, when you go get the new one, they can sync up all your data and make it just like your old one. And that is a fantastic feature. Isn't that wonderful?
That's a legitimately wonderful, great thing.
Because I got an Android phone, and the last time I had to change the motherfucker, it took me an entire day to get everything back the way it was on the other one. So that's great, except it also means Apple has all your data.
Yeah.
Now, they're not supposed to be looking at it.
Yeah.
So if they're not looking at it, though, why are they advertising Chivas Regal to you?
Yeah, that was another thing, because I remember that's what sent chills down my spine, because I was like, I don't even know what Grand Marnier is. And even if I did, that's not my thing. My thing was always just vodka. So I was like, but it would show up on my Instagram. I'd be like, Tommy, like, have a, and I'd be like, that's weird, because that's creepy. That's creepy. And it, on days we did loadouts of shit, we got a shipment of this, and you know, I have to be taking pictures of it. That night, I would be getting recommendations for this, like, here's this bacon peanut butter vodka. And I'll be like, huh, you know, that's a little eerie. That's a little creepy. Just like, It was fucking weird. I was like, I don't like this. Roger, I got to go pee. 6 p.m. I got 1 hour pee. I got to go to the pee. I don't know why all of a sudden I decided that at the 1 hour mark is a piss break. But you know what? It's a piss break. Roger, monologue. Tell them where they can get your book. Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect.
Hey, Prime Intellect, any other of my writings available at Amazon.com. If you want a print copy, particularly of Prime Intellect, go to Lulu.com and look for it. It's the same price, but I get a lot more of the money because Amazon doesn't take their cut. But we have a lot more stuff on Amazon, including ebook versions. Also, if you go to localroger.com, I have links to a bunch of my stuff. Some of it is through Smashwords. If you don't mind reading it through your browser, it'll ask you to pay, but you can set your price to zero. I don't mind that. I used to host it myself, but I was told that doing that caused them to derank my website because it was duplicate material. Then Google ended up deranking the website anyway, so whatever. But you know, you can also get convenient ebook EPUB copies of a lot of my stuff there, and it buys beer. Tommy? And we still have to cover this iCloud thing. Because somebody's doing something with your data they're not supposed to.
And we are back, Roger Williams. What are you laughing at?
Oh, just I was giving the spiel about where to find my stuff and how you can
get
stuff. Okay, so anyway, so we know because Apple screwed up that they tipped their hand.
Mm-hmm.
We know that they are using the stuff in your iCloud to advertise to you, even though you have not actually shared or published it or done anything with it except looking at it yourself.
That
is like so the mistake. That is the point where the Germans put a fourth wheel on their Enigma machine. We don't know what the hell is going on, but we know something is.
Something, that Grand Marnier Gate, right? Watergate, Grand Marnier Gate. Yeah, that's the moment where I was like, hold the fuck up.
So anyway, this is my position, is that what I believe is that asking these companies to not use this data, to throw this data away, is like asking a 12-year-old with a cable modem in 1998 not to use Napster.
Yeah. Just promise me you won't do it.
How did that work out?
I think they tried to sue didn't the RIAA try to sue Napster for something? I think it's the biggest case ever in history. It was like $73 trillion.
And they went through a phase of trying to sue the individual users, and none of that worked out. And the thing is, it was like a complete whack-a-mole. Now, in the United States, our government is pretty much bought and owned by the business community anyway.
Yeah.
So there's not a lot of pushback in a meaningful sense against this.
Yeah.
But there is in the European Union. They have this thing that they passed called the right to be forgotten, that when you delete your data, it should really be deleted and not kept forever, and that they shouldn't be tracking everything that you do. And they're kind of serious about it. And I've been looking at this, and my personal theory, you're going to love this. I think the main reason that this pushback exists in Europe is because, in a practical sense, this is going to make it impossible to have an affair. It's going to be impossible to have meetings of a secret society.
Yeah.
This is a whole cultural thing that goes back. And I can't get out of my mind a comment that was made by a female French politician when Bill Clinton was going through his travails. And I forget who it was, but she said, "We think it's charming that your presidents have affairs because that's their culture." It's one of the perks of being a powerful man in this culture, and it's like it's expected.
Yeah, sure.
If you're the wife of the powerful man, you expect him to have a mistress. If you don't, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
And
Jackie Kennedy. Eleanor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And to the, in their society, to the idea that this will become impossible is really, you know, they don't like that. That's not good. So they're, but it's, again, it's like pushing back against the wind.
Yeah.
The thing is, it's like, how effective was the RIAA against the music? The most effective thing that they've done about the movie situation is have streaming services that are somewhat convenient and affordable so that it's easier to do it legally.
Yeah. And it's cheap enough that you'll do it. Right.
Right. And that's, you know, and the thing is they're fucking it up. Because it's like now, instead of having a single place where you can go, and I want to watch the last episode of Stargate again.
Sure.
Okay. I have no fucking clue where I can go to do that. Actually, I do. You know where I can go to do that? DVD.com. I can tell Netflix to send me the DVD, the plastic disc. Because you know what? Once that plastic disc is pressed, it's a physical object. Even though it's obsolete as fuck, once that plastic disc exists, they can rent it to anybody who comes through the door till the end of time.
Yeah.
Because of the doctrine of first sale. The problem with streaming is all this shit goes in and out of licensing. You never know where anything is available, you know, and that's bullshit.
Yeah, yeah. You know, to watch Amazon, YouTube, Netflix, which one is it? Yeah.
And if any of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, and they're making it worse. It's like, what the fuck with Disney Plus? It's like, so now, if I want to see what, if I want to watch a Star Wars movie, I've got to subscribe to another service because Netflix isn't going to have it anymore? That's bullshit.
You know what? I'm realizing as we're saying this, you know what? I think it's all intentional. They're just making different TV channels. We're back to square one.
Well, what it is they're not getting the picture. They're all acting out of individual greed instead of realizing that they need to work together. If they really want to stop the piracy problem, which they think is a huge problem, right? You know, the people, most of the people who are stealing content are doing it because they can't get it legitimately at either a reasonable price or at all, or through the service that they want. You know, I've bought Amazon Prime for a couple of years just to watch The Man in the High Castle.
Same. I did this summer. Yeah.
Yeah, I will do that. But a typical person watches a shitload more TV than I do.
Yeah.
And if you're tastes are more typical of an American, then all of a sudden you're looking at, you're already paying $60 a year for your cable modem, and now you're doing $15 for this thing and $10 for that thing and $8 for this thing and $20 for that thing, and then you still can't watch the goddamn episode of SG-1 because it's not anywhere. That has to come to an end.
What happens is you just start pirating, and we're back at square one. You just
right,
go, fuck
we're
it.
Back at square one because fuck you go to BitTorrent, and it's there.
You just go to Google, movie S1 E5 free online. You just go back to 2000. You just go back to that original free files online.
So the thing is, it's that. The problem is that with this big data thing, we are the movie studios. It's our data. Mm. And it's the companies that are using it. And what are they using it for? You know, we're talking about, okay, they're sending you ads for Grand Marnier. Well, that's creepy enough.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're also, it's like Amazon is going to know everything you bought because you probably bought it from them.
Yeah.
And, all right, now what the fuck sense does it make? I bought a lawnmower from them about 8 years ago. It was a little electric real lawnmower, so it was practical to buy it online. For the next month, I had ads for lawnmowers. It's like, I just bought a lawnmower. I don't need a lawnmower now because I just bought one. Why are you wasting my time?
Yeah.
So there's, it's not always as intelligent.
Yeah.
But more, it's just that it's there and it's available for any of these entities. And this is before the government calls all these guys in and says, Yeah, guys, we know that you have all this data and we want it.
Yeah.
And if you want to do business in our country, you're going to give it to us.
Yeah. And we won't tell the people that you have it if you give it to us.
There was a, you're familiar with the TV series, The Orville? It's a Star Trek parody by Seth MacFarlane. So it's a rather you would actually probably like it. It's if you're familiar with Star Trek at all, then it's a parody version of Star Trek TOS, the original series, where Seth MacFarlane plays this kind of inept captain of a sort of medium class starship, and it's making a lot of fun of the Star Trek tropes. But the seventh episode of their first season, they stumble across this planet that has about a 21st century level technology, right? So it's us. But they don't have a government in the traditional sense. The entire planet is basically run by something that looks an awful lot like Facebook. And everything is your social score. And so it's like, if someone sees you do something they don't like, minus. Or someone sees something that's like, plus. It's like a pure democracy in that regard. No one can stop anybody from voting on you, and your vote, your social score is everything. If your score gets too low, businesses will stop doing business with you. There's a scene toward the beginning of the episode where a woman is just trying to buy a coffee and she can't because her social score is too low and the business is blackballed her. They won't do business with someone whose score is below 20 or whatever it is. And if it gets too bad, then the police arrest you. They don't actually have a court system. What they have is the social score, and they have a referendum on the social thing, and if it turns out too badly, they lobotomize you.
Jesus Christ. Probably not far off from the CCP, man.
Well, and the thing is, this was meant, obviously, very transparently, to be a comment about Facebook and the way people use it on Seth MacFarlane's part. But the thing is, China is trying to fucking implement it.
They're not trying. I'd say they're fucking doing it, and they're probably doing it well.
Yeah, they are actually implementing a social score thing where that they don't do it as a pure democracy. They have paid spies that rat on you and score you. But they've had people who couldn't buy rail tickets or couldn't buy airline tickets because their score was too low. And this is so far, this is just in beta. They haven't actually rolled it out universally yet. But it's like, this is another one of those things in the, it wasn't supposed to be an instruction manual thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But they're like, hey, what a cool idea. And, you know, the problem with this is what happens if there are errors in the data set? There's no mechanism for correcting them.
Errors.
It took all kinds of movement for us to get the mechanisms just in the Credit Reporting Act in the United States so that if there's an error in the data that's reported to your credit agencies, that it doesn't just ruin you and you have no recourse.
Yeah.
Now, we're creating this whole thing that's orders of magnitudes worse than that.
Yeah.
And there's no accountability. There's no, and the thing is, there's no possibility of any accountability. I don't see how you control it. Again, it goes back to, how do you stop that 12-year-old in his basement in 1998 from downloading songs from Napster?
Yeah.
He's got the cable modem.
Yeah.
How are you going to say, hey, songs? What songs? I don't know about any songs.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right. You give someone a fucking internet connection, then you're like, don't watch porn. All right. Now I'm walking out of the room, and I know you're an 18-year-old guy and you can't keep your pants on for 10 seconds, but I'm leaving. And here is a fiber optic connected to a global brain with millions of hours of naked women doing, or men, or whatever the hell you want, or people dressed up as an elephant doing whatever you want from 144p to 4K. Promise you won't. I promise. Fuck out of here. It's the same. Yeah, you can't take this away from them.
This is that for companies.
Yes, that's what it's. This is, we are the porn for them. They are like, they're like, oh my god, where you are, what you look, what you Google, the coffee you buy. They're just like salivating.
Yeah, and it's not going to be practical to stop it.
Yeah, there's no reason to stop it.
I don't see any other endgame now. there was a very interesting book that I read in the 1980s. David Brin, who also wrote The Postman, wrote a very ambitious novel called Earth. It was an ensemble novel with many characters, and it was pretty cool. It's long, though. It's about that thick. But it's cool. It was set 40 years in the future from the mid-80s, so we're about to hit this period in time. But in his version of the future, there's black holes whirling around inside the Earth, and we don't know what to do about them, and there's gravity lasers and all kinds of cool shit. He had me at gravity lasers.
Gravity lasers? Like, okay, that's
gravity lasers. Yeah, there's a scene where one of the characters wants to show off a little bit, and he uses his gravity laser thingamabob to pick up an iceberg from Greenland and fling it at the moon.
Hey, man, if you're trying to impress her on the first date, I don't know what else. Hey, baby.
So, but anyway, in the background to this story, which would have been in their story, their version of the aughts, you know, the turn of the millennium, there was a nuclear war. And Brin admits that he was having a little fun with this because the instigation of the nuclear war was over financial secrets. The fact that so much of the Earth's wealth had been stolen from the common people and all, and hoarded by rich assholes who stored it in Switzerland and various places like that. And when they came for the Swiss stood their ground, and they ended up nuking Switzerland.
They had it coming. It's about time.
And Brin admitted in the afterword to the book that he was just having fun with this. Okay,
it's been coming to them for a long time.
But where he was going with that was that the society that this created had the idea that privacy itself was an obscenity, that secrets were obscene because secrets were what had caused this violence.
Yeah.
Turn off the fan, sorry.
So this was a very interesting take on things. And at the time, it seemed kind of wacky. Mm-hmm. Okay. Of course, I'm real familiar with doing things that seem wacky at the time.
Yeah.
Writing.
Yeah.
But I think that we are almost headed for a place like that where it's going to be impossible to have a secret. It's going to be impossible to have an affair and keep it secret, because if your GPS signal goes to the same apartment on the other side of town 3 or 4 times a week, then it's just going to be a matter for someone to put it together and go, all right, we just need to go case this and see which apartment he's visiting.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's going to be impossible to have a secret society or a secret organization, but that also means, and governments love this, it'll be impossible to have an opposition
movement. Yeah.
Government. You'll be able to keep tabs on everybody. Think of all the people that will just be like salivating over that.
Yeah.
And we may be headed for a world where that's the reality, where the mechanisms of control are going to be virtually unstoppable.
You can't overcome them. There is no resistance. This isn't some romantic grab your gun and your oil lamp. It's like,
anybody who thinks grabbing their AK-47 is going to do anything against the actual government is a fucking idiot anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Which is why I recommend building bombs. Hey, if you're going to be on the list, you might as well earn it. Roger's like, I don't know who this man is.
I bet this man once.
I have you've been on here a lot, Roger. You're going in that cell right next to me. We're both going to the gulag together. Everyone that's been on this podcast, we're going to the same gulag.
Yeah. Well, we're going to find out that the people who are too far on the left and the people who are too far on the right are all going to be sharing cells.
Oh, yeah. Or they're all going to be sharing the fucking office and killing us centrists. They're going to be like, that's what you get for not taking a side.
It depends on how it says. But the thing is, all this data is out there.
Yeah.
And it's not going away.
Yeah.
It's being collected. My neighbor's Ring doorbell is ratting me out every time I go to work.
Every time I walk outside with my pants off, they're just taking their – there he is again.
Yeah. And it's like Ed Snowden said. It's like, you know, they were only supposed to record the foreign nationals and the foreign communications. But, of course, they recorded everything because they could.
Yeah. It's
and what are you going to do about it?
Yeah. And how are you going to find out about it? Right?
Yeah.
I'm going to request my data. Your data doesn't exist. That exists behind a top secret classification. Fuck off.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's like, oh, Google. Yeah, Google. I want to know how much of my location data you're keeping. Oh, we've anonymized all that. We don't have any of that.
Would you like some Grand Marnier, though?
Yes, we noticed you visited Total Wine 6 times in the last week, and
and you're like, oh, okay, I'll take it. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's James Bamford talks about that in Shadow Factory, but he talks about it. Like in Vietnam in like the late 2000s, it was like, dude, don't Google Democracy Forum into your search engine. No, but because their SWAT team is going to come through your window. So people would, like, you know, try to read. Just read. I just want to read the Constitution. I just want to read the U.S. Constitution. It seems interesting. I've never been to America. Whatever. I found it translated to Vietnamese. Yeah, I'd just like to read it. What is this whole Bill of Rights thing? Motherfucker.
Yep.
And they can squash it before it even foments into a real thing. When you are just curious about what happened in Tiananmen Square. Nope. Here they come through the windows. Nothing happened in Tiananmen Square. We're going to go make sure you know that nothing happened.
So, I mean, I wish I had better news, but the thing is, I think that's where it's headed. That, like you said, that Predator drone with all the cameras and
Gorgeous
shit.
There.
Are they? Actually, give a few more years. They're not going to need it.
Yeah.
Because every fucking camera is going to be on the internet, and all they're going to have to do is network them together.
Yeah. Because the thing about Gorgon Stare is that it's not photo, it's video, so it's just constantly recording a whole city at a time. So when they do see something they want to see, they just rewind it. Eventually, it's going to take another generation, but it's going to jump up to space based, and then it's just going to be there all the time.
Yeah, and the thing there is it's possible to envision something like a keyhole satellite, but with modern data technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
absolutely. I think, wasn't it Ben Rich that said? I mean, Ben Rich, the CEO of Skunkworks, who died in like 1995. I mean, his most famous quote is, "We now have the technology to take ET home. If you can imagine it, we have it." That was his, you know, crazy one. He said George Lucas would salivate at what we have, which is crazy. But another thing he said, a lesser known quote, is there is no private conversation on this planet. You and a friend can be on top of Mount Everest and you can whisper. It's not private. But he never went into that more, and that kind of scares me. Because I always thought if you really want, you know, me and Roger could go for a walk in the woods and, you know, put our mouth below our collar.
Well, a lot of that depends on how interested they are in you in particular. He's right if there is a particular interest in you. He's not necessarily right if you're just, Tommy and Roger, random schmucks at the moment.
Yeah.
But if you are Tommy and Roger, the candidates for president and vice president, and, then you've got a different level of attention being placed on you.
But as it always happens, though, there's always the same evolution. Is yes, you first have the technology that you only put, you know, president, vice president candidates. But once that's possible, it waters down to eventually get everybody. That's how it always happens, right?
Well, it's like what happens when it's a 100 terabyte hard drive or a 1,000 terabyte hard drive, and you have cameras literally every few feet. There's been a few science fiction novels that I can think of that went there. Norman Spinrad wrote one called Agent of Chaos, which was extremely dystopian, where the entire world, every civilized space, had these cameras. They called eyes and beams, every few feet, public space.
Yeah.
And the story was that if the central monitoring computer that was monitoring these cameras saw something illegal, it would pop the cover of the beam, which would expose an intense radioactive source and kill you. It was instant death sentence.
That went from 0 to 100 real quick. That was instantly just instantly kill the bad thing. Just
and the thing is, the question as the novel progresses is whether this capability is real or whether they're just doing it at random to create the impression that they have this ability.
You could argue is equally powerful.
Everyone knows that people are occasionally killed by popped beams.
Yeah. That was a conspiracy I always thought about, was what if Ed Snowden, what if he is still working for the NSA? What this is this was just the best PR campaign ever.
So that was one of them. Now I'm trying to remember what the other one was that I had in mind.
Yeah, that's crazy, right? That's like the idea of like it's like a scripted video, but it's made to look like a real like defense contractor speaking at an expo. It's really I need to find it, but it's the idea of like these little suicide drones. They're like the size of like a butterfly, and they have like a tiny little C4 cap on them. And
yes, I saw that. The killbots.
Yeah, and they go down, and then it comes to the U.S. You can just drop 1,000 out of a plane, and then not only that,
and the whole tone of the video is like an ad, and it's so enthusiastic. Yeah, Nuclear is obsolete.
Yeah, he's like, isn't that? Did you see that? That's this guy's just like coming in his pants, and like the idea is eventually you just plug it into the internet, and you find it from where it starts, a hashtag. So if you said hashtag resist President Trump, it's like the idea, or whoever, it's just, you know, resist Obama. The idea is like this killbot comes and it finds you and it hits you with a little C4 shaped charge right in the forehead. So it's truly wrong think eliminated at the source. And he's, did you see that? Did you see? The guy's just like, oh yes. Right? But it's eerie though, right? It's eerie.
Yeah, and the thing is, if you look at the follow-up to that little video, he says that this that video does not include any technologies that don't exist. all they were depicting was that they had been miniaturized and improved to a certain extent, but there was no fundamentally new technology necessary to create those things. So, you know, and they also, it's like, I like the line, it's like, you know, the cargo plane opens up the rear hatch and zillions of these things come out. It's like, enough, you know, $20 million buys you this, enough to eliminate half a city.
Yeah.
The bad half.
Yeah, there. Yeah, and it's who's defining bad. Don't ask that.
The half that you don't like.
The half you don't. Yeah, flies into like lecture rooms with like, you know, like colleges and pop and just blows people's brains out. And it's just like, but what's the next step? Shit would be nanobots, right? Through, what if you get nanobots in everyone's bloodstream at all times? So as soon as the thought goes into your cerebral cortex, you don't even have to type it. It just recognizes the pattern of electrical impulses, and it's you like, I wish I had more privacy from the government. It's boom, it just blows your head off. It's just real-time genetic engineering, right? It's just culling the herd.
Well, speaking of someone who knows quite a bit of physics and computers and stuff, I have serious problems with nanobots. I don't seriously believe in them the way that a lot of the singularity people do. I think the problem with nanobots is that the way that they are justified is like as if you took, say, a catalytic cracking unit in an oil refinery and you said, well, this is so big and it can process so much material and create so much product. This is what the nanobot people are doing. They're saying a nanite can take these inputs and create these outputs using so much energy, okay? Like a catalytic cracking unit can. And because a catalytic cracking unit is 16 feet in diameter and 37 feet tall, we can put one in your backyard. Well, that part don't work so well because that catalytic cracking unit is in the middle of a 40-acre plant full of staging areas, pre-processors, post-processors, all kinds of things that are necessary to feed it those inputs and make use of the outputs to store and ship them and all. And the nanite people really don't seem to get that. I mean, I've worked in industry for almost 40 years, and that's the first thing that cries out to me when I read all this stuff about nanites. And I say that as a guy that wrote nanites into the Curite, yeah. The curators.
Yeah.
But again, on that, that was the 7 billion year old technology.
Yeah.
So maybe they had time. But I don't see nanites doing some of the things that are portrayed simply because I don't see the staging. I don't see the process control. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that happens in an industrial facility to make it possible for this relatively simple device in the middle of it to do its magic.
Yeah.
And what I don't see is if you've got a nanite that's sitting there waiting for an oxygen atom to do its next thing, what gets it the oxygen atom? Where does it come from?
Yeah.
How is it scheduled? How is it staged? What is the mechanisms for that? And they don't have any idea for that. And I think by the time you get to that kind of organization, you're talking about something that's not nano anymore. Now, it may be a huge improvement for a lot of technologies. You might be able to build a plant the size of this keyboard that can produce billion transistor integrated circuits. And you just start it up, come back next week, and boom, it's done. I can see that being possible.
Sure.
But as far as things pumped into your bloodstream, as far as things, you know, building arbitrary biological matrices with basically nothing to start with,
yeah,
except that? Naturally, it's like it's you know, where does the inputs come from? How does it deal with the randomness of available raw materials?
Yeah,
I have trouble making that work in my head.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm just being the old fuddy-duddy, short-sighted guy, but I think.
Yeah, no, I got
my reasons. You know, it's just having seen a lot of industrial facilities, most people have no idea what is involved.
Yeah.
In, you know, and I've seen a lot of this on, you know, people saying, well, you know, I'm going to build a, you know, this boat and go out and circle the world and all. And you talk about they're building a 50-foot boat and they think they're just going to do it in their backyard. And it's like, do you realize how much support crap you're going to need?
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a matter of spraying styrofoam at a wire frame. There's a lot more to it. Even if you make that technology work, there's a lot more to it to make it into a functioning environment, to, you know, to make it do all of the stuff that it needs to do to either support life or to perform whatever function it's supposed to perform. And most people have no idea how fucking expensive industrial crap is.
Yeah. Yeah, like to build a Tesla, you don't need a factory the size of a Tesla. You need this whole apparatus to make.
Yeah. Well, it's like to give an idea. If you go browsing through the Granger catalog, you know, any of these industrial supply catalogs, industrial crap is way more expensive than consumer crap because it's got to function in extreme environments. Mm-hmm. It's got to do extreme things as far as pressure and temperature. It's got to be extremely accurate if it's doing measurement. Because, you know, it's like the humidity sensor in your dryer that knows when your clothes are dry would be considered a sad joke in a chemical plant.
Yeah.
Okay. A sensor like that might cost $200 or $300, which is more than you paid for your dryer.
Yeah.
Okay. That is the case all over the place. You're looking at valves that cost 3 figures, tanks that cost 6 figures.
Yeah.
All this pipe that has to be welded up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's your iPhone camera versus the one on a Hollywood set.
Right. And really, it's that even worse by an order of magnitude. What you're used to thinking of is how you would perform a function. When you start doing it industrial scale, particularly if it's something that involves high energy or toxic chemicals, radionuclides, of course, anything like that, the measures that you have to take to control things, to make sure that it goes right, become astronomically expensive. People have no idea. The company that I work for has branched out in recent years, but for many years, what we mostly focused on was weighing devices, scales that weigh things. Now, that itself is a vast field, because every large plant in the world has a truck scale. Mm-hmm. And so when trucks come and go, they weigh the entire truck so that they can tell how much they bought or sold from that truck. A truck scale costs between $50,000 and $100,000, depending upon how fancy you get with it. A laboratory analytical balance that you need to do to do fine assays in a lab. The cheap version may be $1,000.
Yeah.
If you really need accuracy, and there are very accurate ones out there, it might be more like five figures.
Yeah.
You have what they call deck scales, platform scale, for like a 4x4 platform scale that you would put a pallet on to weigh the pallet. These things are common as dirt in industry. They're a couple thousand bucks a piece.
Yeah.
And people are not thinking, if you wanted to do business at this scale, just to measure the stuff that's coming and going involves more money than most people realize.
Yeah.
Is involved. And that's before you actually start doing anything.
Yeah.
Once you start actually cooking things or reacting things or machining things, then those machines, like a CNC router, is itself a thing. It doesn't exist all on its own. It's got to have a way to get the shavings away. It's got to have a way to be fed. It's got to have a way to be programmed. It's got to have a way to handle the things that come out the end that are finished, except they're not going to really be finished because you're going to need to do more work on most of them. And all this adds up in ways. If all you've ever seen is the grocery store and the consumer stuff and what's at Home Depot, there's a lovely anecdote. There's an essay online called "In the Beginning There Was the Command Line." It's by the guy his name is on the tip of my tongue. The guy who wrote "Done It Out in the Magic Kingdom." It'll come to me in a second, but it's an essay. It's online for free. It's called "In the Beginning There Was the Command Line," and it's about operating systems, about how computers, similar to what we've been talking about.
Yeah,
but it's about the difference between an operating system like Linux and an operating system like Windows. Mm-hmm. And the way he illustrates this is he worked as in construction for a few years. And there's a drill that's used in construction called the hole hog. H-O-L-E-H-A-W-G. And it's awesome. It's a block of metal with a pipe handle socket. The handle is a piece of pipe, so that if you break it, you can just unscrew it and put a new one in. And he tells stories about using it to drill holes this big in rafters and solid pieces of wood. And there was an incident where a worker was drilling a hole with the hole hog, and it jammed and kicked him off the 20-foot high ladder that he was standing on. So he was hanging from the drill.
Jesus.
And he just hung there until they put the ladder back, because the drill was because it's an industrial piece of equipment. It is a solid piece of equipment that is intended for one thing: to cut holes.
Yeah.
It doesn't care about anything else.
Yeah.
It's there to cut holes, and it will cut a hole in anything.
There's a certain beauty to that zen.
And that's what he said. The analogy he was headed toward is that as operating systems go, Linux is the whole hog of operating systems. It will let you do anything. If you tell it to recursively delete all of the files on your hard drive starting at the root directory, it doesn't ask if you're sure. It just does it.
Roger, I've got to piss again, but I'm completely down to keep this conversation going. I like it. I'm fine. I drank so much water, as you've probably seen in this podcast. I don't know why I always do that. I'll down two water bottles, and I'll be like, nothing bad's gonna happen. And you know what? Spoiler alert, I always have to urinate. It's the fucking god, it's the craziest thing. I need to get like an astronaut system so I can just sit.
You need to get one of those little bottles that they put under the seat of your car and you're driving along.
I just need to get a full on I was gonna say as I'm wearing my NASA shirt, I just need to get a full on like recycle system. Just like I'll buckle into the podcast and no one will know. You'll just see me talking like Roger, monologue.
Okay, so as usual, this is going some interesting places. I wrote all these notes and I didn't use any of them. Happens every time.
Roger, 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 can't you see? Sometimes your moves just hypnotize. 6:42. Let's I can go for like another 18 minutes. I got an early one tomorrow. So what we are saying is that simplicity of doing one thing. I had a guy on here that I've had on before several times, Brad Smith, who was an armored truck driver. Now he works in a paper mill, and he was talking about the machines that never break. Because the paper mill was built in like 1888 or something. He said they have some like World War I presses. He said they're incredibly dangerous. There's absolutely no safeguards. It's like, don't walk near it, because if it's doing the thing, it's going to do the thing, whether or not you are one piece or two pieces. Like, it has no care for your torso. But
been there, done that, got the T-shirt.
Yeah, but he's they don't ever stop.
There's a machine at a sugar refinery in New Orleans, which is responsible for about 10%. Actually a little more now, I think, of the sugar production in the United States. And on the dock where they unload barges, there is a scale called a bulk weigher. And a conveyor feeds product into a hopper at the top that has a gate that can be closed to surge. And when that gate is open, it feeds into the scale, which is another hopper with a gate at the bottom. And then, so what it does is it fills the scale until it's at a set point, and it's not real, it doesn't care quite how much it is. It just wants to get the scale nice and full, and it closes the surge gate. Conveyor's still going, conveyor doesn't stop. Then it weighs the sugar that's in the hopper, and then opens the gate at the bottom of the hopper and dumps it. Closes the hopper, opens the surge, lather, rinse, repeat. The hopper is about 15 feet square and has a capacity of 40,000 pounds. It cycles every 45 seconds, and they weigh about 7 million pounds of sugar a day on it. And I built the control system that runs it. It was originally, that system was originally controlled by mechanical linkages, mercury switches, and shit like that. The company that I work for hung the scale from modern load cells to make it an electronic scale instead of a lever system. And I designed the computer system, which has been redesigned twice now as the hardware has obsoleted and needed to be replaced. But that is their cash register. They weigh 7 million pounds of sugar a day on that thing, and that is how they bill. That's how they pay for the sugar that they're buying from all over the world. And so this machine is 30 feet high.
Jesus.
And it is about 90 years old. You know, when you go back to the original version of it before we retrofitted everything. And yeah, they're not going to get rid of it. They're, you know, I've got stuff like that. That's one of the more impressive examples. But I mean, I've done a lot of shit like that in my career.
No, I'm glad you said that. That reminded me of, there's a press. And I think it's in like Detroit or Chicago. It's a 50,000 ton press.
That sounds familiar.
It's been around since before World War II, and they revamped it. And it's
there are two or three of those. Just ginormous presses that there's nothing else like them.
No, it's like 100 feet tall. It's insane. But it's built like pieces for every aircraft from like World War II through like the F-22.
Yeah, and all of those old machines have been retrofitted with modern controls, which make them far more useful because they're more accurate now, and they can exert finer control over the pressures and stuff.
So
it's like you've got those, you've got all this stuff. It doesn't go away because it's so frigging expensive. This is the thing about the radio telescope in Arecibo that was recently damaged because one of the cables failed in Puerto Rico. And there's nothing else like it in the world. And everyone's grousing about whether they're going to repair it. Well, of course, part of the problem is that it's in Puerto Rico and our president doesn't fucking like Puerto Rico. But this is like one of the most important scientific instruments in the world. What's going to happen is the only thing close to it is something the Chinese are building. Oh, so we're going to let the Chinese have the only instrument like this in the world. Motherfuckers. Because it's been damaged and no one wants to pay to repair it. And, you know, of course, something like that has been upgraded many more. But they had this cable that's supposed to be able to take like 1.2 million pounds of tension. Because the way it works is a spherical dish that was built into a sinkhole, and the actual radio equipment is suspended above it, like the camera at an NFL football game. You know, it moves back and forth on these cables. One of the cables broke, dug a trench in the dish. Big problem. Okay, but then they had another cable failure. So it's like, okay, the thing needs to be overhauled. It's been there for like, 60 years?
Yeah.
What are you going to do? Not fix it?
Yeah.
Building a new one is probably not a thing that's going to happen.
Yeah, you know, it's more expensive to build a new one.
Yeah. So it's like, let's get on with it. But be it the political situation and all. But, you know, this, some of this old shit, it was done in a heroic age. I mean, we have a machine that we use to test crane scales, and it's about 15 feet tall. It's got a couple of risers and a platform that can move up and down on screws. So depending on whether it's tension or compression, you can put your scale between this platform in the top or this platform in the bottom and either push on it or pull on it. And the base of it is a calibrated scale that we keep in synced to the National Bureau of Standards. You know, it's all traceable to the standards. And people send us their crane scales to calibrate on it. And this is all very important because those scales go back out into the oil rigs and all. And what those are used for is to make sure the damn crane don't tip over. And that machine was built in World War II. My boss bought it surplus. I remember when he cut this deal. He bought it surplus in the late 1980s, and we retrofitted the controls and the electronics to bring it up to those standards of the day. And we've done more work on it since. But yeah, the basic machine was built in World War II, and nowadays, to have a new one made would almost be so extravagantly expensive. They're really not available.
Yeah.
There's no one making them like this anymore.
Yeah.
So what happens when this one finally goes tits up and all the others like it? Is this somebody else going to, you know, where is the capability going to come from?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like a computer that you just overhaul and you get the brand new one.
You take the old one that's this big and you chuck it and you replace it with an Arduino.
Yeah, no, it's not. Yeah, it's something. It's something like NORAD, right? It's like the general, like, yeah, the living space inside of the mountain. It's like that is. They'll be able to use that in 200 years because the general thing is like we have a hollowed out space inside of a mountain, right? Whether it's 1500 or 2000 or 2500, doesn't matter what the year is. That's like a pretty solid just thing in general, right? Hole inside of a mountain where we can live.
Yeah, well, and where we're hopefully protected from nuclear bombs raining down on us.
Which means a very select few, not not me and Roger.
Yeah, right. Yeah, not you and me. But
not you and me. I mean, us. I mean, we paid for it through taxes.
Our people.
I think Ed Snowden said it best. He was like, "Never forget, national security. It means the head. It means the elite of the nation. It's security for them, not us. National security is security for the state. But that press is." It's insane because it's still like parts of it are like it's considered like critical infrastructure because it's like when we need like huge wing pieces for like B-52s or C-5 Galaxies or anything or even commercial shit, but like Uncle Sam is like we need that, and so there's still like you can't get that close to it. There's still like armed detail that's been there for like 80 years.
Yeah. Now that you're telling me about it, I do think I've seen an article about that.
It's the Mesa. It's called the Mesa. MESA. It's called the Mesa 50.
Because the machines like that have names.
Because there's so few. I mean, no, really, yeah. It's like this thing is like, yeah, it has like a nickname because there's nothing like it, and it's something like you don't think about, but apparently, like, that was one of the things where like we got plans for this thing through Operation Paperclip. Like, that's how, like, unique. So it's not even, like, plans for a rocket or a jet engine. It was, like, plans for just big, dumb press. It was, like, that was the fruits of, like, World War II. Is like, we have a bigger printer than the Russians. The Russians got the pieces for the 30,000-ton one. But we got the guys that have – but seriously, I'm not even making this up. But we got the guys who knew the plans for the 50,000. And it was, like, fuck, yeah. And the Nazis were planning –
we're going to build this puppy, yes.
Yeah, and Eisenhower was, like – when it came – where I guess after Truman, Eisenhower was, like, build this and, like, upgrade it. And, like, the Nazis were apparently planning on building a 500,000-ton one. Which, of course, was their own downfall, right? Because everything had to be grander. But still, you don't think about it. But it's like, what's like a national security asset? And it's like this big fucking press. What does it do? It's just big and heavy.
It squishes things.
That's it? That's it? Well, fuck, all right. I guess keep it going, right? But, yeah, there's a word for that. It's called, I looked it up, there's a great subreddit for it. It's called Skookum, Skookum, and it sounds like an obscure porn genre, but it's not. But that's exactly what it means. It means like a wrench that's been in a warehouse since like 1850 and it still works, right? It means a big press. It means, a big drill, a big something. It works forever. You could throw it off a cliff. It could be in a warehouse for 80 years. You pick it up. You get the cobwebs off, and it's still – it's like a sledgehammer would be like Skookum. It's just fucking – it's going to work forever, right? That's what it means is, yeah. But, yeah. I was going to say, Roger, that a great podcast would be to do a complete go back would be nanotechnology. That would be, if you're well versed on it. I give you a blank check. You always come up with a good topic, so you don't have to take any directive from me.
I tend to be a little circumspect about things that I've done in the work environment. But yeah, I've seen some. I know where a lot of bodies are buried. That's
not good.
Do you really want to know where your food comes from,
dude? I'm more closely related to food production. I know how gross it is. I know how fucked up it is. I know how it is. Like, we put Hitler to shame with our camps, our like chicken camps. Hitler had nothing on us, but it's
well. I will tell you, the one of the stories that I told in one of the corrosion articles was we went into a chicken plant that processes several hundred thousand birds a day in Arkansas, and we were installing a piece of equipment, and they needed to break a conveyor line in order to make room for it. And we went in at the end of the shift on Friday. And all these guys, of course, all the cleanliness directives go out the window because it's maintenance day. And all these guys descend on this line that's worth millions of dollars and start cutting it up with acetylene torches. And these are not like engineers. These are plant guys that, you know, they're plant maintenance guys. And they're like, cut this line down, install new bearings here so that the conveyor can go around and we make room for the new thing. And they're cutting shit up, and there's welding going on, and all this shit flying around and everything. And then it all has to work 48 hours later, or this plant is losing $500,000 a day.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, it's like, and these guys are getting paid like $13 an hour.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's the food industry, and they're like,
have you read Fast Food Nation?
No, but I probably know everything that it has in it.
That book is, I had to read that in college, just by Eric Schlosser, who wrote a really good book called Command and Control. But his book about Fast Food Nation and all the plants, Jesus, it is dark. It is fucking dark. Not just for the animals, what happens to like the workers, the undocumented people falling in like big blenders and shit.
Yeah, that's not even the big. It was like, okay, like one of the stories is like in that chicken plant, one of the coveted jobs is called live hang.
Yeah.
Where they are taking the live chickens from the delivery truck and upending them and hanging them by their feet from these specially designed hooks that convey them throughout the plant on these conveyors that hang from the ceiling toward the various processes. And it's considered one of the most dirtiest, shittiest jobs in the entire plant. And it's like the people who are capable of doing compete to do this job because it pays like $1 an hour extra.
Jesus.
And I wrote a couple of articles for Corrosion called Plant, which was about chemical plants, and Food Plant, which was obviously about food plants. And so they were a distillation of my observations about industrial work settings. That might be, maybe that would be a good topic for next time.
I think we found it. I think it's, again, you're the only guest that just gets carte blanche. You show up. No, you're good at it, man. I had on Vince Houghton, Nuking the Moon, who I think is a lot like Dan Carlin. You're like them in that I don't even care what you're, because I take it as this is my weekly like one-on-one like tutor lesson with Roger. I just so happen to be uploading it as a podcast. But you're very good. I mean, in the teacher role, you're very good at it. I don't even care what we're learning about. No, I mean that sincerely. That's why one day when you start your podcast, you're just going to have 50 episodes out of the gate. I'll just send it to you. But you're a good, you choose something, and I think the caveat is it's something you're interested in.
The thing is, one of the things that we have in common is that we are interested in just about everything.
Just curiosity in general, yeah.
Yeah, and the world is full of wonders. It's full of horrors, and some of the horrors are wonderful, and vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, but they're all interesting. It's like, as bad as it is, it's all interesting, right? It's fucking, whether it's a big press or whether it's how to, you know, industrialize and monetize killing chickens, or whether it's nanites, or whether it's fucking, I don't. It's all. Yeah.
There are some interesting contrasts. It'll be a good topic that would make a full podcast to just explore the differences between manufacturing and food production. Because as a teaser, I'll point out one of the things that I was told. The plant manager of a food processing plant once told me, as I was like musing about different things I had done, that the difference between manufacturing and food processing is that in manufacturing, you take in a bunch of elements that have been manufactured to specification. If you check them out with your tools and you find that they don't meet the spec, you send them back. They don't meet your process requirements. And you assemble them into a product that you then make sure works and you sell it. In food processing, it's the other way around. You take in a bunch of individuals that are variant, that are no two are the same, and you're taking them apart in order to create products that can be sold in different markets and used for different purposes. And you're constantly adjusting because you're not always getting the same input. You don't have that much control over it. Even when you try, there are variances that can't be eliminated because they're living things. And so you're constantly jockeying to see what do you have available, what does this incoming stream make possible as far as your outgoing products. And so it's a completely different mindset. Even though it's two industrial facilities that are all full of fabulously expensive crap from Grainger, they are operated in completely different ways.
Well, I think we found the topic for the next podcast. I'll send you a text or an email. We can choose on what day. I appreciate your flexibility this week.
Yeah. The only wrinkle I had today was I had the doctor's appointment.
Yeah.
And I wasn't quite sure how that would work out.
Yeah, I got
now,
you.
Normally 4 o'clock would be a little early for me on a weekday. Yeah. So.
I do like the Sunday slot. I like getting you earlier. But I also don't want to take your weekend. It's up.
Actually, I don't mind. That would work out fine. I figure you were probably trying to keep fresh for Vincent or something like that.
I'm an idiot, and I booked. Normally, I go through this. We'll wrap this one up in a second. But normally it's a 90. I call it the 95% ghost rate of potential guests just not responding. And of the five that do respond, one says yes. I don't know what happened, but I sent out all these emails, and then without realizing it, it turned into like a 98% yes rate. So all of a sudden,
you got lucky.
Yeah, but it was lucky, but it was like, oh fuck, I have like 15 authors in 16 days or something. So right now I'm in this death spiral of I wake up and before I'm even out of bed, it's turn on, this is Audible, and it starts, plays the book, and by the time I'm going to bed, it's finished, and that's the guest tomorrow. And it's, and I can't, I don't want to cancel on any of them because it's like, I finally got them.
No.
But now, so I'm, it'll be finished the day before Thanksgiving. I'll be finished with this death spiral of podcasts. But after that, I'm going to put a limit on two authors a week. It's just like, I never expected for them all to say yes. I got greedy and they all said yes. And it was like,
damn it, I got lucky.
So, and because I'm a cocky, arrogant motherfucker, I'm like, I'm not saying no to a single one. So I just bought, I've been tearing through, like, I mean, I guess I trained for this as a pre-med student. I know the grind.
There you go.
I'm like, it's coming back.
Actually, you've been doing well. I mean, that's like, I've been, because you've had some fantastic guests the last week or two.
The last week, I've just been pressing them out.
I'm just like going, where are these people coming from?
Yeah. Well, they all said yes. So now I'm like, fuck. So, yeah. So.
But yeah, no, I actually like the Sunday afternoon slot. That works out well for me. And that way, because that way I'm not juggling work and coming home and trying to get ready and stuff like that. And, that's fine.
Let's do it.
What did we do? We did like 3 o'clock.
3 o'clock.
Set my time.
Yeah. So 4 o'clock my time. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's do 4 p.m. Yeah. Sunday. Well, I will see you at 3 p.m. your time, 4 p.m. my time on Sunday. And until then, Roger Williams, author of my favorite book, Metamorphosis of Prime Intellect, which will be in the top comment and in the description. My favorite book. It's a good read. It's a fucking, it's, and I don't need a, it's clearly my favorite book, so I'm not even going to go into it more than that. It's fucking great. Roger, of course, as always, Thank you very much. Another interesting episode. And next week,
I'll see Sunday.
Next Sunday, we're going into food processing and plant. Or my brain's fried. That's what we're doing Sunday. You know what it is.
Industry
and stuff. Stay safe, everybody. Yeah. Be nice to each other. Try to avoid the oncoming Civil War. And try to enjoy Thanksgiving. And God bless America. And blah, 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 blah. All right, Roger. I'll see you, my man. Peace.